This is the first talk I've given in over 2 months, which is unusual. I've not had that kind of break. Clearly, the last 2.5 months have been very intense. And as much as I would try to sit down and did on a number of occasions to try to say something to this camera and to all of you who are looking at it, nothing wanted to come out. Clearly, there was no perspective for me in the middle of all of what was going on. There was just the experience itself. And the experience was very, very intense on many, many levels, and wonderful and difficult, all of the above. And there was nothing that would formulate itself as something to be spoken about while I was going through it. Only now, as I sit here today, am I starting to feel some completion or wholeness to what exactly took place. Most of you know that I was in London and working on this musical, and it was a dreamlike experience on every level, meaning one that it was a fulfillment of a dream, even a dream I didn't know I had. You know, I never thought I would do a Broadway musical, or a West End musical in this case. I never imagined that being part of my life, really. The experience of going through it also had a dreamy quality. It was really so otherworldly, so Bardo-like, so unexpected to live in a dark theater and watch these extraordinary images form around you, to hear this music erupting, to hear people singing and dancing every day, and then to watch audiences come into experiences and to watch the response, which was really remarkable, and much bigger even than what happened in Manchester, which was the early part of this year. I keep wondering what it would have been like if Buddha had had his enlightenment in the middle of doing a Broadway show, and what his experience would have been and what our world teaching would be as a result of that. But the great lesson for me is that spiritual awakening is true to whatever is happening. And if you are sitting in a monastery practicing Zen Buddhism for years on end and suddenly have this awakening, your awakening will be influenced by and conditioned by the environment in which you are sitting. If you are working on a movie, as Julia was, and I have a brother-in-law who had an awakening sitting on the witness stand in a jury. He kept saying, "Who are they talking to?" And suddenly realized that he wasn't there. And another student in Los Angeles, who simply put his name on a piece of paper and offered it to the flame and said, "Take it," and it did. Just took him completely. You know, you don't know where these releases will come from or what they will mean, but they will each have their own very personal and very real context. And for me, the last 2 months have been energetic in ways that are, for me, pretty much indescribable. They're just so much happening, so rapidly, so deeply, so fully. And I can't say that it was all completely joyful. There were periods that were just the opposite of joyful. And there were things that took place that were actually very painful and difficult. And yet you have to ask yourself, and you do when you have a spiritual life, why should it be other than this? Why should it be different? What makes me different than anybody else just because I have a spiritual life or an awakened life? The answer, of course, is nothing. Nothing. You are what you are. Experiences are what they are. The extraordinary thing about having a spiritual life is that it amplifies, intensifies, deepens, enriches, clarifies, and emboldens much of what you are. And it's remarkable to live a full and deep life. So many people want a spiritual life to remove them from life, to separate them from the ups and downs, the pains, the suffering, the drama. But that rarely happens unless you're already on a path that separates you from life, a monastic path perhaps. And even that doesn't separate you, because Rudy always talked about the Zen monk who kills another Zen monk for stepping on his flower. You know, drama can come out of any condition, any situation, and you really are not necessarily free of life just because you're living monastically or separated from the world drama. Drama is drama, and it's our life. And it's how we live it that teaches us. And we are all here to learn extraordinary lessons. For me, the awakening of last October was a release from Bruce, but in no way was it the finality of Bruce, and I was really led into that by the experiences of the last 2.5 months. If you want to see yourself in ways you don't expect, put on a Broadway play. It's really remarkable what occurs, the demands, the resources that it draws up, the dealing with the unexpected, with the critical part of it. Some of you know that the play, although wonderfully received by many people, was not well received universally. And some of that, although I planned not to read any reviews at all, the ones that I unfortunately stumbled upon were painful. They were really painful, and I didn't expect that. I was sort of blindsided by it, and in a way still am sort of vibrating with that, but it has been probably the best teaching. The best teaching is to get what you don't expect, to get what you don't ask for, to get what life wants to bring you. And in no way does life insulate you from anything just because you have a spiritual clarity. I sort of knew all that when I was working through my years with Rudy. You know, all of my spiritual practice in the years with Rudy were quite remarkable, and I kept thinking, you know, I will be insulated from life. I will now be able not to have to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. And it never took place. But what did take place was an ability to deal with it all, an ability to take it on, to find strength in whatever life brings you, and to become a stronger person. And then you go to the next stage and you realize there's strength beyond strength. There are things you have to draw from that are beyond anything you imagined. And everybody in this room knows what I'm talking about in their own personal lives. Things happen. They happen to you economically, they happen to you spiritually, they happen to you physically, biologically. Life is a really powerful experience. It's intense. Rudy used to call it brutal. And it is. Life is brutal. And what is shaped in that brutality, what comes out of that, is so fundamentally you that it's hard to really understand going in that you need all that to finally arrive at yourself. Life needs to be what it is. It can't be otherwise. And I appreciate it. I really do appreciate it. What I do get from my journey is something that my friend Bart talked about. He said, awakening is a thin blanket on a cold night. It needs to be understood as that. And I will use the word awakening to talk about all spiritual life. People want it to be a warm comforter that keeps you warm no matter what. It's not that. It never was intended to be that and will not be that. Spiritual awakening is a thin blanket. It's thin, but it's there. It's enough to take the edge off, if you will, and it's enough to give you the stillness to open to and absorb what comes. I learned so many things during the course of this period, and way too many to try to summarize. But one of the most important was this. I have not been away from teaching for such a long period since I became a teacher. Even when I was making my films, I taught every Sunday. I kept teaching, Sundays and Wednesdays sometimes. I kept working, I kept being a teacher. But during this period, I stopped. I just stopped. I just didn't teach anyone. I didn't have a sangha, I didn't have a class, I didn't talk to anybody about this work. And I found that it felt like an absence of something crucial. That it was clearly missing. And I didn't have anyone around who particularly wanted a class, you know, and I didn't want to sit down and say, hey, you, I got to give a class. So it didn't happen. But what did happen was really kind of fascinating. People would arrive at my doorstep and they would bring with them the energy of this spiritual being that we all get to share on a weekly basis. My sister and my brother-in-law arrived, and I was going through a very difficult time, and I don't know how to describe it other than a sense of absence of this. And I opened the door, and they were standing there, and it was like an onrush of joy, total joy. And they didn't even have time to say hello. It just was so much joy came through the door. And my brother-in-law, who had called me actually after this courtroom drama, I hope, Alan, you don't mind my talking about this, he was on the stand, I think, because his building had mold in it and they were suing him for it. And they were yelling at him and saying horrible things about him. And he really did sit there and go, who are they talking about? And on the ride home, he called me and he was no longer Alan. He just wasn't that person anymore. It had just gone away. And I didn't even know who was calling me on the phone. It was just so unlike my brother-in-law to sound like that. And then I kind of put it aside, because I'm not holding on to all the information that flows through on a daily basis. But when he arrived at the door, I realized instantly that it was still operating. And he and my sister came upstairs, and for the week that they were with me, it was like a living class. It was like we never sat, we never did this, but we were just being together in a state of so much joy and bliss and content richness and gratitude for each other's presence. And I saw what it means to have what we have in this room. What it means to have that in your life. When it's not there, it is really not there. And when it comes into your life, it is the greatest gift that I know. There's nothing like it, to be present with the other. Only thing that's beyond that is to be present with your inner self. But I have to say, when that is not working in a dramatic way, and a lot of us know what that feels like, when the other comes to you and brings that with it, with them, or with whoever it is who walks through the door, the recognition of it is so powerful, so potent, and so beautiful that you feel nothing but this profound sense of gratitude. And it happened again. My very dear friend and student and teacher in Los Angeles had this awakening. I described the piece of paper, and he will describe it to students better than I will. Literally giving his name to a flame and letting it be evaporated and suddenly discovering that it did its job. There was no more Terry. He came to visit us also in London. The flow of visitors was amazing, and each had their own content, but the awakened visitors brought something that was indescribable, truly indescribable, and everything in my being radiated outwardly, and the connection between us was a singularity of such power and such remarkable presence that it was really distinctively different than the day-to-day life. Distinctively different. And it was remarkable. It was truly remarkable. And we just talked, we talked and talked. And he and the others who came to visit as well, Each came bearing gifts. Everyone brought something, which was hard to describe, but it was like completion. I thought, you know, Bruce, I think you're going to die at the end of this, because you're done. You've had completion with everyone you need completion with. All the major people, all my relatives, everyone I needed to have the final whatever it is happened. I could have left the world like that. I kept really, truly expecting that that would happen. I thought they were just, I don't know what would happen. In London, it's easy to just step off the curb and look the wrong way, you know. So I figured that probably would be what would go on. But it almost did twice, actually. But it didn't happen, and here I am. Here I am, having had this phenomenal completion with people. And now I have arrived at a place of indescribable unknowing. I mean, I do believe this musical is going to present me with opportunity for the next several years to keep working. That's what it appears. And that's terrific. But otherwise, I've retired from my old profession. I've retired from all of the predictable stuff other than showing up here on Sundays. As long as I'm in this town or in LA to do the same thing. That's about the only predictability left, other than I'll probably have breakfast every day and lunch and dinner and those kinds of things. But it's a really interesting place to arrive at. And I will report from the front when I know what it's like. I mean, I'll tell you what it's like, because it's really kind of fascinating to have zero agenda. Zero. I have no idea what that will be or what it will mean, but it is really fascinating. And what I found in London was the agenda was given to me, and I opened the door to it, and it did not stop pouring. It was rich beyond belief. The richness of it was extraordinary, and if Blanche hadn't been there to take over the overflow, I don't know how it would have all worked out. It was so dynamic. And I got a note from a student, San Juan Capistrano, actually, who said how grateful they were to have a spiritual teacher who had a dynamic life. And I realized there is value in that. There are spiritual teachers who have dynamic still lives. There are teachers who have dynamic meditative lives. But whatever is happening here is happening for its own reason, and I hope it has value for whoever is listening, including each of you in the room. There's a particular kind of teaching that emerges from this, and it just simply and interestingly fits into Rudy's paradigm. Because Rudy was really a teacher who basically said, your spiritual life is your life. This, your life is it. What else is it? And he made us conscious of the fact that our effort in the world was our effort in our inner being. It was all the same thing. And if you have a really dynamic life, you are going to be working on a million different levels at the same time. Rudy talked a lot about working in time and space, on the horizontal and the vertical. And that's really what it is. You're working on multiple levels simultaneously, and you're working your ass off, and you're doing it with a sense of amazement. I mean, that's really, for me, the awakening, more than anything else, was the amazement at what this is. I thought awakening and spiritual enlightenment was some kind of ending, and truly it's a beginning. It's really the beginning of spiritual work. It's just, you're no longer doing it, it's doing it. It's just happening. However, and one of my friends who visited said this to me so brilliantly. I was talking about whatever it wanted. I'm available to whatever it wants. And he said, what is it? And I realized at that moment, it's whatever I want. It's whatever I want. I am it. And trust me, that's a big revelation. I am it. I am that. It's not what it wants. What do you want? What do you want? And you are completely one with what you want. And believe me, you get what you want. And if you haven't gotten what you wanted, it's because you haven't wanted to get it. And if this enlightenment awakening thing is driving you a little crazy, it's not a bad thing. You know, some people hear me talk about it and they want to run the other way. Some people want it so badly that they're obstructing it from happening. And most of you are just kind of, well, it's interesting. you know, maybe someday. But I'm telling you, you're the creator of your existence in ways that you cannot fathom. You cannot fathom. You are it. You are that. And I don't mean you as the particle self, as the ego mind self, because you are that. You are the ego mind self. But you are also the self itself. And when you know that, and when you own that, and when you accept that, and when you go, I am that, life becomes what it always was, what it always was meant to be, and that most of us have lost touch with from early on. And the whole idea of awakening is really the idea of realization, realizing, oh yeah, I'm it. This is my world. This is my universe. Everyone who's in it is mine. Everyone who surrounds me is part of my fabric of being. All of my successes and failures are all part of it. And you can't own them as because, you know, like you did something right or wrong. It's just part of the configuration. It's part of the drama of human being. And I'll tell you, we all have drama. And I was in the middle of one of the most joyous experiences of my life, and there was great drama and great difficulty and suffering. And it was amazing to me to watch all that. And what I understood from that is we each have these elemental parts of our being that need to be experienced and addressed and lived, every one of us. My granddaughter has them, and she's only 7 months old today. She has elemental needs. We have elemental needs. Our drama is real. I'll tell you what's not real. I mean, it may seem real, but the stock market is not real. The debt ceiling is not real. What's happening in every other country of the world is not real. I know that sounds totally terrible. It's like, how can that not be real? It's happening. I can read it in the newspaper. Don't read the newspaper. Don't turn on the TV and tell me what's going on. I'm not saying put your head in the sand. I'm just saying, what is your immediate world? What are you really relating to? And if you're relating to all the big drama around you, that's your choice. It's okay. But if you want to truly relate to it, get on a plane and go to the Sudan, go somewhere and do something. But if you want to just sit down and be uncomfortable about it, then own that. Own that that's what you want to do. But I'll tell you, you've got enough drama in your own life to deal with. You know, I look at Talia, you know, she wants the next thing, whatever it is, that toy, this person, this whatever it is, she really wants it. She wants to crawl there. She would love to walk. She would love to talk. She has these huge urges in her. You know, if I try to add to that, you know, the stock market, you know, I don't know what she would do with that. Luckily, she can't figure that out at this point. And most of us don't have to figure that out. We really don't. We are as free or as trapped as we want to be. And trust me, a lot of us like being trapped. A lot of us like being in pain. And not only that, the universe supports that. I have no idea why, but it supports it. If you want it, it's yours. You can have it in any design form that you like. You will actually be able to have, and in fact already do have, the life you want. Amazing as that may be, or as unsatisfying as that may be. So fix it, or don't fix it. Love it or hate it. Doesn't matter to anybody but you. Totally your choice. Absolutely your choice. And you're going to learn from every bit of it. That's the great thing. You'll learn from every bit of it. I mean, I really was feeling some kind of shame in London because I was going through so much suffering at various times. And I just finally went, this is part of it. This is part of it. You know, I thought I was free of all that. I was not free of it. You're not free of it. You know why you're not free of it? Because you're alive. That's why. You're alive. Life is life. And to be free of it is what? To be dead, maybe. You're alive. Embrace the totality of it. Let it inform you. Let it give you what it wants to give you. We are here to learn something unbelievably remarkable about existence. Every one of us, through our own body type, through our own mindset, through our own family history, through our own sexuality, through our own creativity, we're all going to learn in our own very particular way. And trust me, the universe only wants to learn it through your way. It wants, that's why we're each in this form, because it wants to know itself through what you are. And it can't know itself through what you are if you don't know it. I mean, it can, but it knows itself more completely if you truly know your being, know your own presence. And that's what we're here to do. And this sitting here in practice, trying to arrive at that, it's both necessary and absurd at the same time. And I've talked about that a lot, but this idea of wanting to get here, wanting to get where you are, is kind of crazy, because you're here. You're here. You're it. This is it. And what you want to do is to be here in a state of comfort. Well, forget that. It's not comfortable. It's not comfortable. You show me anyone who's living in a state of comfort. You might get 5 minutes of it. You might drug yourself into it for a little bit, but nobody lives in a state of comfort. We're all uncomfortable. But when you stop fighting that, when you just go, okay, what happens? It's totally amazing. You're not comfortable, but it doesn't matter. There's no struggle. There's no tension. There's no frustration. It's like, oh, you just are. And that's what you're looking for. Just to be what you are. And that's the joy of spiritual awakening, or let me put it more simply, the joy of spiritual pursuit. Arrival is one thing, but you don't get anywhere but here. So you arrived, but where are you? So spiritual pursuit and spiritual arrival are kind of the same thing, except I will tell you, after awakening, you don't feel so much that you're doing it. You are doing it, but you're just appreciating how big it is. You're appreciating how connected you are to the totality of unfolding, and it's not all totally you. It's you in the grand sense, not you in the small sense. So anyway, that's what's been happening for the last 2.5 months. I had no idea what today would be like. I had no idea what it would be like sitting with you guys, talking this through, trying to bring this to some kind of clarity. I'm glad I'm doing it. I'm glad you're all here. And for the moment, I think we should keep doing this and see where it goes. And, I can't say much more than that. Are there any questions?
Bruce, do you think that some of your suffering may have been attachment to wanting this project to succeed?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. Yeah, no, I mean, I talked about this when Talia was born, and there was a moment in her being born that looked like, uh-oh, maybe something's wrong. And my whole body-mind instinct rushed toward prayer, that this be right, that she be okay, that nothing terrible would happen. I cannot tell you how complete that was. And I kept saying, is this Bruce doing this? And what came out of it was, this was something bigger than Bruce. This was a universal wanting for things to be well, to be good. That it wasn't personal, it wasn't Bruce, that God itself wants this. That I call it the rooting interest, that God wants us all to have everything, to have it all work out. And in some way there's this incredible drive toward that. And so having this play, I saw people were loving it, and it was really wonderful, and I love it, and I wanted everyone to love it. And when one of the primary critics in this country hated it, it was really painful, unexpected, really unexpected. It was like blindsided, and that was very, very painful. And also, as we were going into it, there were choices being made in the play that I thought were wrong, and I couldn't influence their changes in the moment. In the end, I did. It took, you have to learn how to operate in life, but it took being patient, deeply patient, and expressing your needs without emotion and with sincerity that finally allowed things to change. And they did. This one particular song in the play, which had been problematic, changed. And it was wonderful to watch it change. But did I have an investment in this? Did I deeply care about it? Yes. Was it Bruce? Possibly. The whole experience was so Bruce-centric because everybody said, Bruce, 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 you know, I was the writer. You know, in Broadway, the writer is like king, unlike movies where you are not. And so I had the experience of having to be Bruce for a lot of people, at the same time not feeling particularly connected to Bruce. But Bruce kept rearing its head all the time, and that was fascinating. And yes, that was the source of some real suffering. You know, as I said earlier, I thought Bruce was gone. There's a lot of crevices in there. You know, when you work with the, you know, with your teeth, you know, you find stuff you don't even think is still there. You know, that's really what it's like. You know, you just keep going and going and go, oh wow, and that stuff looks like really cruddy. You know, it's really the worst of the worst, and you dig it out, and it comes out, and if you don't dig it out, it will show itself. And the brilliance of life is it will create circumstances that are pinpointed to you to get it out, because that's what this is all about. It's just clarity and clarity, cleaning and purity, and even the most pure of us. And I look at someone like Nityananda, you know. You know, I watch movies of Nityananda walking around. This guy clearly was deeply arthritic. He could barely walk. You could see the way he was walking. It was just painful for him. And he slept on concrete. He slept on concrete every night. You know, this guy, he was bearing up without any resistance to the universe and the body that he was inhabiting. And he did nothing but give out love and clarity and presence to anybody who came within his sort of purview. That's what he did. And that's what we're all growing toward, if you will. We're becoming that. And I can say you are already that, which is true, but there's still some dental flossing to be done. Anybody else?
You may look at the reviews because you had expected the good, and you got a lot of good reviews. But when the bad ones come in, it's kind of like a balance, and it zeroes it out, and it makes everything like nothing.
Sort of. For me, it was just awkward.
Close.
I mean, I thought now I have to come back, and everyone's going to look at me like poor Bruce. You know, his play had bad reviews, or some bad reviews, or whatever it is. But you know, for me, it's always been like this. And every movie I've ever written, except Stuart Little 2, had bad reviews. and the bad reviews are always in the newspapers where all my friends live.
Right. So, you look at it as a reflection on the reviewer.
Well, no, of course you can. And I really was going into this, you know, our director said, do not read any reviews. And I had decided for the first time in my life not to read any reviews. And I literally stumbled upon the Ghost review. You know, it was a Saturday and I was looking at the New York Times and there it was. And I was just like slammed in the face with this review. And of course, then I realized everyone I know who's read this now is feeling terrible. And how do I tell them? No, because we had wonderful reviews, and the show is doing great, and this, you know, we're selling out, and you know, all of this stuff. But I was in suddenly a way that I had to, this is clearly you can hear it in the voice. Bruce. There's a Bruce talking in all of this, and it was just uncomfortable.
Did you send him a thank you note?
No, I wrote him a really terrible letter, which I never sent. but I always do. I always write terrible letters to people, and when I get really angry, and I don't tear them up. No, I save them actually. But I write unsent, and I leave them unsent because it feels so good to get that off your chest. So that's what I did. No, Bruce really came into the picture here, and I saw that happening. And yes, that does cause it causes suffering, and you don't even know it's still lurking around until these kind of moments happen. But it's great training, you know. And you know, I've done my best to clarify all that, get it out there, and kind of put it behind me. So I think that's pretty much done. But now we have probably now the New York opening, you know, and then we have to go through this again, and then, you know, then it's going to happen. I don't care about South Korea and, you know, Germany and Holland and places like that, but New York's still going to be the one last. They're going to get into the, they're going to dig in.
Don't forget?
No. Trust me. I get the lesson. I know the lesson. I'm prepared for the lesson, but it still gets me like that.
You wear tinfoil on you.
Hey, I'll wear something. Or you can write me a note the day before and just remind me. Okay, that's the value of having friends.
So I think what you just said is that even though you can have a detachment, there's still that other side that comes in and wants to attach you.
I thought it was gone.
Yeah.
So what has happened was surprise.
Right.
And the surprise of that has been meaningful to me. You know, and I'm telling you, there, as far as I can tell, I don't know if I speak for everybody, you know, in spiritual practice or people who have awakened. I don't know. I mean, I'm speaking for Bruce because that's all I know. But I was surprised by what came up, you know, the attachment that was there, you know. And I think there are certain things like your children, your grandchildren, and your musicals that get you. they get you. You don't expect it. And you don't know how deeply you're attached until that something happens. And then that's the big lesson. What do I do with that? How quickly do I put it behind me? And for me, that's really the teaching. The thing happens, and then you kind of let it go. You know, you move on. And I'm pretty good at that. I you know, I was a little surprised at that I wasn't as good as I thought. But it's all instructive. You know, and either you use it for that, or you just beat yourself up, or you just live a life, you know, where you're always mulling around the same old bone. And, you know, I mean, if I hated the critics who hated Ghost 21 years ago, I'd be a miserable soul, you know? And most everyone, every review that came out about Ghost in the movie was not good. You know, they didn't like it. But it still went on to get nominated as the best picture, and, you know, I got an Oscar. You know, there was all this, it didn't matter in the long run. But boy, when that first happened, I remember on that film, it was really painful. What do you mean they don't like it? I mean, someone reviewed your children, you know, and they told you the day they were born that this is a waste of time and they should never have had it. And that's literally what some of them said. What do you say to that? You know, you want to kind of take them in an alley and. But I
was thinking about this and then I thought I'd ask you and then I thought I wouldn't ask you, but now that you've kind of gotten to this point, when you were leaving London. And you left that behind. The show is still going on.
Mm.
Do you almost feel like you left a child behind?
Sure.
Yeah.
But they send me reports every day.
Okay.
They do. And they tell me how many people stand at the ovation at the end, whether we have standing ovation or not. I look for that every day. Are they still standing? You know, it's been every show so far, yes. You know, we've been very lucky about that. And so, and I know the cast is counting as well. They're waiting for the first night when nobody stands. And so far it hasn't happened. The roar of approval at the end of the play is so overwhelming. People, they don't just stand, they yell, they scream, they stomp, they whistle, they do everything. They go out of their mind with pleasure at this show. And that's a great thing to see. And it's very deeply touching. You know, and people are crying, you know, they're sobbing. Toward the end of the show you hear things like what is this? So it's such a strange experience, you know. And the ushers all stand around to see if everybody's okay because they want to help people out of the theater if they need it.
Medic.
It's
I did that in the movie.
Pardon?
I cried in the movie.
You know, people cried in the movie and they cry in the play. It's very similar, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's
one review. I read that Dame Judy Dench.
Yes, Dame Judy Dench.
She came and she was so tearful and told that it's the best thing that happened.
She actually sat with me. We sat together in the auditorium. And
they didn't wrote it in review, but they could have told you.
No,
it was like night before.
It was a few nights before the play opened, and she sat with me and she kept gripping my arm and she's crying and she's laughing and she goes, "Stupendous, stupendous." She was truly loving the play. It was really, you know. I know she, you know, and I've told this to people now too. Andrew Lloyd Webber came the other night and said that we were a hairbreadth away from being the best show of the last, best musical of the last 20 years. And that's a nice comment. He one song he didn't like that he would like us to change, which I think we will change. But it was a very good comment for the show. People have been very favorable. It's just certain critics, and mostly what I've discovered about these critics, and I've learned this in earlier my films. If you present them something that is really heart-centric, emotional, and that is spiritually driven, they do not want to go near it. They hate you for doing it. They hate you for bringing them out of their head and telling them there's this feeling here. They do not want it, and they will punish you like mad for that. And I have gone through that now so many times, and I feel bad about it. It's always hurtful, and there's nothing I can do about it.
That was your Hollywood experience, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Always.
Except when they would say too much religioso or whatever.
Yeah. Yep. Or, you know, Time Magazine called me the Dr. Kevorkian of American cinema. Because I write about death all the time. You know, I mean, look, you have to get...
T-shirt.
Yeah, right, exactly. You just have to learn to bear it. And I thought I had, but this time I thought we had a winner that nobody would dislike. You know, you can't have people yelling and screaming and loving the show and then someone saying it's horrible. It just didn't compute for me. It was such an unexpected change. Anyway, I don't mean to bore everybody out there with this discussion. Is there any other spiritual questions here?
Well, you know, getting snake bit is the nature of expanding.
Hmm.
But you also get to see everything else, too.
That's true. Mm-hmm. That's true. No, look at, I mean, you know, the pain of this has been very, very beneficial. And there's nothing, if you use it right, that isn't beneficial in your own development. Nothing. And, you know, if you want to use it to shut down and be miserable, fine, but you don't have to. So is that anybody else? Okay, guys. Sorry.
Okay. Yeah. When you were talking about painful experiences and how we store them, it's different than our good experiences. Our painful experiences, you can go back to one that happened 40 years ago and rethink it, and you can bring up all the emotions, have all the physical responses, all the mental responses. The nice things, not so much. So we really do pack them on and reuse them.
Well, that's our evolutionary sort of need. The bad experiences. I mean, I watch it with Talia. When she falls and hurts herself, the next time she is in a position to do that, she lowers herself down in a very different way. The information comes in so quickly that she does not allow herself to fall the same way or to make the same mistake twice. It's really amazing. Children are, I mean, she's become my teacher at this point, and I'm just observing how it all works, and you know, we do learn from our pain more than we learn from our pleasures, unfortunately, or fortunately. Anyway, thank you guys very much for coming. See you next Sunday.